Right, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get the show on the road. From your printed programme, you'll notice there's a slight change. Cassandra Clark, unfortunately, can't be with us. And at very, very short notice, Roz Southey has taken her place. And it's fortuitous because today she has her third book published called A Secret Lament. And so we wish her well. Edward Marston is also indisposed, as you probably noticed, so you've now got me, J.K. Rowling. There's been a steady growth in this subgenre of historical crime over the last 10 or 15 years, and no period of history is safe. In fact, people scour history and indeed prehistory looking for areas they can write about. And I think it's important to state at the start that there are two main ways of approaching history. One is to take it seriously and treat it with respect, as all the people on this panel do. The other way is what I call the Hollywood route, where you never allow documented fact to interfere with a good gag. My favourite is when the medieval knight rushes into a courtyard, pulls out his sword and says, "Men of the Middle Ages, we go forth to fight the Hundred Years' War." Another great one, of course, was Cleopatra, starring Elizabeth Taylor. And when she makes a triumphal entry into Rome, preceded by 200 young ladies distributing flowers, followed by a large number of musicians, I have to ask Roz about this, blowing instruments that look like a double hernia, and then 200 Nubian slaves pulling this enormous float at the top of which she's sitting there. And Mark Antony, played by Richard Burton, turns to Caesar, played by Rex Harrison, and says, "This is the biggest thing to come to Rome since Romulus and Remus." He obviously hadn't met Silvio Berlusconi. One of the great things about writing about the past is you can explore it in all sorts of ways. If you've read, as many of you have, The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley, you know the wonderful opening line, "The past is another country. They do things differently there." Well, they might do, but oddly enough, they do them from very similar motives throughout history. Looking into any period, and you'll find people are prompted by the same passions, the same jealousies, the same self-interest, and they're still subject to the same eternal recurring failings of the human race. On this and other subjects, I will introduce my panel to speak about. Firstly, at the far end, Roger Hudson, who comes to us from Ireland, who is an expert in Greek history, and his first book, Death Comes by Amphora, is set in Athens in the 5th century. As I'm sure most of you know, 461 BC was a seminal point in the history of Athens, and it explains why in the book. It's the most wonderful insight and one of a few books about history that really goes into political intrigue in great detail. From there, the next person, chronologically, as it were, is Jane Finnis, in the middle here, who writes about the Romans' most northerly province, Britannia, specifically in the 1st century AD, 98 AD, in Yorkshire, which is, in fact, where she lives. Her heroine, Aurelia, in fact, runs a mansio, an inn, which is halfway between York and the coast, an area which I'm sure some of you may know. And they're fascinating books to give you an insight into Roman life, and particularly into the status of women at that particular time. Now, by a strange coincidence, R.S. Downey, whose real name is Ruth Downey, and she may explain later why it's called R.S. on the front cover, writes about Roman Britain less than 20 years later. And her first novel, a wonderful novel called Russo and the Disappearing Dancing Girls, is set in Dever, which of course was Chester, as I say, in 20 years later than Jane's, in the 2nd century AD, which I think was Emperor Hadrian's overlordship. It's a fascinating book. You will find that her name is very much often linked to Stephen Saylor and Lindsay Davis. Well, don't be misled, because believe me, she has a voice which is entirely distinctive, and she doesn't need anybody's coattails to come up on. And finally, we have next to me, and Roz Southey, I didn't know was going to be on this panel till the last moment, so I've not had time to read more than the titles of her books. She writes about the 18th century, and it's nice to jump from the ancient history up to a more modern period, and her particular area is music. So her central character, in fact, is an organist the 18th century. I'm not quite sure which particular one, and the harpsichord is called Charles Patterson. Wonderful reviews I can see on this thing which was handed to me before I came in, with wonderful titles like Broken Harmony, Chords and Discords, and Secret Lament. My first question is, what attracted you to the period about which you write? Roger.
Well, it goes a long way back. I actually studied ancient history for A-level at school, and I got intrigued when doing ancient Greece by a guy called Ephialtes, who brought in the reforms that took power away from the aristocrats and gave it to the rest of the people, you know, the lower classes, as it were, and by introducing the radical democracy, where everybody had a vote, well, all male citizens had a vote. But there was so little known about him. He brought in the reforms, he was promptly assassinated, and there's very little more about him in the history books. And this stuck with me for years. I thought maybe there was some cover-up by the historians who really didn't want us to know anymore for some reason. And it stuck with me. And many, many years later, I the friend who was in the book business, the publishing business, and I said that I'd like to write about it to get a chance to research it more. And he said, well, the only way you're going to do that is get it published is if it's a historical crime, a historical mystery. So I came up with the plot, and of course, when I looked into it more, the reason there's so little known about in the books about Ephialtes is there, in fact, is very little written anywhere about him. You know, apart from the reforms and the assassination and a state funeral. And I discovered recently the fact that he was used as a bogeyman. Mothers would say to their children, be good or Ephialtes will come and get you. So it must have made quite an impact at the time, which makes you even more intrigued as to how powerful a politician he was. And besides the fact that Pericles supported him. And obviously as a result of the reforms, Pericles rose to power, and we got the Golden Age of Athens. So, very important character. But that's what attracted me to this specific period.
Well, in fact, Ephialtes appears in the book, and Roger's very kindly provided a list of characters for you. And for a first novel to handle 40 characters, all of whom have good, you know, walk-on speaking parts, I think it's quite an achievement. So, do look if you can find it for Death Comes by Amphora. Jane, why did you get interested in Roman history?
I just always have been interested in it, I think. I mean, I remember as a very small child, we lived in York for a bit, and seeing the remains of the Roman walls in York, and then a bit later on walking down straight roads, which I thought all of the straight roads in Yorkshire were Roman. In fact, some of them weren't. They're sort of post-agricultural revolution, but I just assumed if it was really straight, it would be Roman. And then at school, you learn about how modern the Romans were in many ways. They had things like central heating and education and poetry, and then you learn about the really good stuff, you know, the orgies and the gladiators and the sort of... and then I got hold of Robert Graves' wonderful books, I, Claudius and Claudius the God, when I was about 13, read them, couldn't put them down, and was completely hooked. But I was working for many years in jobs involving writing but not fiction, and when I got time... retired and got time to think about writing fiction, I wanted to write a mystery because I've always enjoyed reading them, and I thought, well, I'll set it in Roman times, you know, there's no contest. Then I've got a wonderful excuse to read up, to visit Roman sites, to find out all about this period, which has always fascinated me, and I focused on Britain. I mean, I did think to start with it would be nice to write about Rome, apart from the fact that lots of other very good people have already done that. I thought, well, no, it's a lot easier. If you want to know something, you know, really simple bit of detail, like what birds are about or what time of year a certain flower is out or when it gets dark, it's a lot easier to do that in the place where you live rather than having to do it by remote control.
Ruth, what about you? How did you get interested in Roman history?
Well, I wasn't for a long time, I have to admit. But my family used to live on an island just off the coast of Essex, which is only linked across the salt marshes to the mainland by a road which is supposed to have been put in by the Romans. So every time I went to school on the school bus, I was actually conscious that we were going over a Roman road. Mm. There was a rumour that the road was haunted by a Roman soldier late at night, but I was of the age where you weren't allowed out late at night, so I can't verify that, I'm afraid. But when the bus got to school, it went all the way around the one-way system in Colchester, which gives you a nice tour of the Roman walls. But I must say, the penny didn't actually drop until years and years later. And I went to a museum with the children, and there was a caption there that said Roman soldiers weren't allowed to marry, but they were allowed to have relationships with local women. And I thought, yes, there's got to be a story there, really, hasn't there?
Ros, could you tell us specifically which part of the 18th century you write about?
Yeah, I write about 1735 and 1736, really early on. It's all the fault of the day job, really. I'm actually an academic. Don't worry, I don't write really, you know, dry as dust academic stuff. And I did a PhD just about the turn of the millennium, which was looking into music making in the northeast of England. Really interesting things like, who were the musicians? What did they have to do to earn a living? What did music mean to people? What were concerts like, for instance? And in order to find out about these things, I read a lot of 18th century newspapers, which are absolutely wonderful. They're just the Suns and Daily Mails of their day, you know. Lots of gossip, lots of scandal. And I kept coming across these wonderful gossipy stories that I just could not put in academic work. And I wrote a PhD dissertation, handed it in, found myself unemployed, and decided that I would write up some of the good stories I'd found in the 18th century newspapers. So each of my novels is actually based on a true event or a true situation, which I fictionalised and expanded. The fault of the day job and the newspapers.
A very good piece of advice there for anyone wanting to write about history. Always look for newspapers. In this country, they really began during the Civil War, when they were basically propaganda sheets. And then after the Restoration, Charles II came along and saw the value of them and got a man called Mr. Lestrange to edit a sort of official newspaper. And they grew and they grew and they grew. And then we had that wonderful efflorescence at the end of the 17th century and on. So any of the period from 1651 really up to the present day, newspapers are a wonderful source. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more about your central character, your protagonist, and how you came to invent him.
His name is Charles Patterson. He's an organist, he's a harpsichordist, he's a violinist. In those days, musicians played everything. I think the only thing he hasn't done so far is sing. And I think that's probably one step too far, because I can't sing either. But he's an impecunious musician, which was the fate of most musicians at the time. And he's actually based on a real person. There was a man called Charles Avison, who I hope one or two of you might have heard of, yes, who is or was a very well-known musician in Newcastle-upon-Tyne during the 18th century. And I just fancied writing a novel using that character, and I thought, no, I can't use Charles Avison. I'll give him a different name. And then, of course, as soon as I named him differently, he evolved into a slightly different person. But the situations he faces actually are the situations that real musicians would have been in the 18th century. And he just can't keep any money. I mean, it just slips through his fingers very quickly. Though he is on the verge of having a romance with a very wealthy woman. So that's the sort of second strand in the books.
Well, the best kind of romances, I can recommend them. Roger, you've got two protagonists. You've got an 18-year-old boy and a slave, and they remind you very much, there's a wonderful byplay between them, of the characters in Aristophanes, when, in fact, it's the servant character, the slave, who is the bright one, and the main character, who is actually not all that bright and has to be led. Is that a fair assessment?
No, I think Lysanias is quite intelligent. He's just is young and inexperienced and rather impetuous, and lands himself in all sorts of trouble. Why them is dictated by the fact that it's a very complex and in many ways alien society, and I wanted an outsider whose eyes we could see the society through, which, you know, so that is. He's seeing it as strange and new. At the same time, he then needs, which is Lysanias, you know, just 18, come to back to Athens from being brought up in a distant military colony. But he needed someone who at least knew some of the ropes. So I gave him an elderly slave, Syndron, who's the family slave, who had spent time in Athens before Lysania's parents had emigrated. But equally, he's been away 15 years, so he's not too au fait with the latest developments. And we see it through both their eyes. It's also because it was a very compartmentalised society. You know, and in fact, at this time, when there was, as it were, a revolution which removed the wealthy from power, or from absolute power, I had to further in split Lysanias into he's the heir to a wealthy family, so he's an aristocrat by birth and inheritance, but he's been brought up in the military colony by his father as a carpenter, so he's an artisan as well, which gives him the ability to talk to both sides of the political divide without although trying to keep it secret from the other side that he's doing so. But even there, they could get at most areas except one, which is the women, and the women, especially in the wealthier families, were kept to the house and segregated, and you know, a man just couldn't approach a woman and ask questions that might need to help in the investigation. So they had to have to rope in Philia, who is the teenage widow of the uncle who has been murdered, and who Lysanias finds he is duty bound to marry to provide his uncle with continue his uncle's family line, but she steps in and assists with the investigations as well. So that gave me three viewpoint characters, which gets complicated at times. But it was the only way to cover the society.
Is she going to become a sort of regular sidekick, Philia, in future books? Is she going to take more of a part in the investigations?
Somewhat more, yes.
Good.
Yes.
Ruth, Russo, who was a medical officer, by the way, strikes me as the most reluctant detective I've come across. Nevertheless, he's quite effective. Could tell us a bit more about him.
Yes, he actually stumbled in by accident to the whole story. He was one of the characters in the backstory of something else I was trying to write, which was fairly dreadful and will never see the light of day. He is a medical officer who's come to Britain from, in fact, Gaul. He doesn't come from Rome. And he's intending to make a fresh start after a divorce and one or two other sticky financial problems back at home. And I think he's just intending to spend a little while here and then go back when things have cooled down a bit. But he bumps into a local girl. And I really wanted the local girl in as well, because what really interested me about the whole thing was the way that the two societies would have interacted, the people who came into the country, and how they would have got along with the people who were already here, or not, as the case may be. So, that's the two of them.
Jane, tell us a bit more about Aurelia Marcella.
Well, I echo what Ruth just said. The interaction of the Romans with the native British is very interesting. Aurelia is a Roman. She's lost her home when Pompeii was destroyed. She wasn't there. Well, she wasn't. Sorry, daft thing to say, really.
She was
out of it. But her father had served in the army and served in Britannia and wanted to come back for reasons which don't become clear till book three, and I'm certainly not going to tell you what they are. So he had shipped the whole family back to Britannia really quite quickly after Pompeii fell, and she runs this inn with her twin brother Lucius, who is the legal owner of the inn, but she can't be the legal owner. That I have to be careful, because I know, and reading classical sources confirms this, that a lot of women were very much more independent than the legal system might lead you to suppose. They could run their own lives, they could work the system, but they had very few legal rights or political rights, and so I just have to make sure that I don't suggest that she could do something which would have been, you know, blatantly impossible. But I wanted to write from a woman's point of view, partly because I was just interested and I thought that I could perhaps do it more easily than from a man's, and partly because hardly anybody else has done it. There is only one that I know of, other person writing about Roman era mysteries, who's got a woman protagonist. And I found it very interesting, and the more I look into it, the more modern scholarship and research is revealing that though women don't feature in the written records and haven't left much written record themselves, they did have a much better time of it, certainly in the provinces, than you would think from reading the male patriarchal Roman writers. And I think we were all brought up with the idea that the paterfamilias was sort of a tyrant and could do what he liked with his family, even exposing the children, you know, even condemning them to death. Well, legally he could. In practice, by the first century, he certainly wouldn't have done either of those things. The hurdles that she has to negotiate and the hoops she has to jump through a bit, and the fact that she's resourceful and tough, and she doesn't want to, she's not a feminist, she doesn't think about equality in a philosophical sense, but she does just want to do what she wants to do, and she manages that very well.
I'm very interested that you're both talking about having the conflict between the Roman and the native side. Obviously, the situation is different in the 18th century, but part of the tension in my books comes from the clash between the musicians, who were of a fairly low status socially, and the gentry, or the aristocracy, who were very aloof and tend to be very contemptuous without really thinking about it. And musicians, as I say, were regarded as tradespeople. And when Patterson develops a talent for solving mysteries, it almost becomes another trade that he has, and his relationships with the wealthy people around him, on whom he's dependent because they're the ones paying his money, whether it's as a musician or as an investigator of crimes. He has to be extremely tactful and handle them extremely well, and they're in some respects dependent on him, and yet they are very aloof and very contemptuous and look down on him. And the woman he falls in love with happens to be of the gentry, so there is the clash there between she's above him in class and he shouldn't really be looking there. But it's interesting that you've got two strata of society, or in your case the natives and the Romans, actually clashing. So besides the crime element, you have the social and the political elements there as well.
It makes a good backdrop to a mystery, doesn't it, when you have a conflict between two sections of society, whatever those may be. I mean, it gives you loads of extra motive and extra tension.
How much use do you make of real historical characters? Roger, you use Ephialtes and Pericles, of course.
Well, to some extent I was obliged to, because obviously one of the crimes that needs solving is a political assassination of Ephialtes. So he and Pericles and the top general who is deposed at the same time, General Cimon, all have to feature. But the first draft, they tended to be very cardboard. They were very flat in the background, and then I read it through, and it really stuck out like a sore thumb, the fact they were so different from the others. And one of the things that bugged me about... I like Mary Renault's recreations of classical Athens, but one of the things that bugged me is that these fascinating, real historical characters are in the main... you glimpse them in the background, or whenever the main fictional characters see them or meet them or are in a battle that they're concerned with. So the fictional characters are much less interesting than these real historical characters. You get enough to know that they're fascinating people, but not enough to get to know them, and I find it very annoying. So on the revised, they got fleshed out rather and written up. In fact, it turns out I created a rod for my own back in doing this. When it comes to the sequel, we're into the period, 2 years later, when loads of fascinating real people were turning up in Athens because it was the new intellectual, the centre of new thinking in the world, well, at least in the Eastern Mediterranean. So you've not only got Aeschylus and Sophocles who've been there for some time and the natives, but people coming in like the philosopher Anaxagoras, and there's Damon the composer, there's a Hippodamus, the first town planner, a guy called Artemon, who was an engineer, coming up with, loads of people in in loads of different walks of life. You know, Herodotus was around, having done a lot of his exploring. And it's very difficult denying them, especially as quite a few of them were obviously members of Pericles' think tank. He seems to have had this sort of think tank of intellectuals, and I find it very difficult to turn them away, but it does certainly complicate things.
I think the rule is to use as few real characters as possible, because their lives are so well documented. You might have them doing the most impossible things. I know there's one lady who writes turned Jane Austen into a kind of FBI agent, and clearly in terms of 18th century the 19th century society, she just wouldn't be able to have that social mobility. So you always have to think about that. Jane, what about you? What use do you make of real historical characters?
Very little, because there wasn't much known about the real people who ran Roman Britain from Britain. Obviously, there's a fair bit known about the policy of the Caesars. But I mean, if you look at a list of governors of Britain, there are certain gaps where it says that, you know, they weren't quite sure when one provincial governor's term ended and another one started. I mean, my second book, which was set in sort of 95, 96, they still don't know who the governor was. I followed the scholars and took an educated guess, but I couldn't therefore use a close relative for the governor in case I got the wrong one. So I used a more distant relative, a female relative who didn't bear the same name, and put a historical note in saying, you know, someday somebody will discover, and I've probably got it wrong, but then so has everybody else. But that astonishes me, because the Romans loved bureaucracy, loved paperwork, but so much of it's got lost. If I was working a bit later, I mean, I'll ask Ruth about this, but I mean, it would be wonderful for me to be writing at the time of Hadrian's visit to Britannia. But they mentioned, and Domitian's paranoia as Caesar, the fact that he was constantly and arbitrarily demoting or executing people, that's a factor, but we don't see Domitian himself. So I have been criticised by reviewers who said, you know, this ought to be, you know, set more firmly into the historical background. And I was always brought up that you don't answer reviewers back, really. But I would like to answer back and say, find me the historical details of these people, dear, and I will willingly do it.
Do we have any reviewers in the audience?
Do we have anybody who's criticised me for not? Because that's my answer.
Ruth, what use do you make of historical characters?
I keep them well out of the way. I think other people have written about historical characters and done it very well. They don't interest me very much, to be honest. I think what interests me is the lives of ordinary people, the people who made the pots and made the baskets and kept the roads mended. There's a little while just after the period where I am at the moment, Hadrian brought in a rule that said you couldn't sell your slave to a pimp or to a gladiator trainer unless you could justify it. It's hard to imagine how you would justify it, but obviously times were very different then. But we don't know the stories of any of those people, and there must have been some reason why that legislation was brought in. So although Hadrian may, if I get to book five, Hadrian will be in Britain, so he will get some sort of a walk-on part. I think the interesting thing is we've got so little knowledge of, as Jane was saying, we've got so little knowledge really of what did go on in Roman Britain, that every time they dig up a sort of big building that was built round about the same time, they all say, ah, this must have been built because Hadrian was coming. So he will have to appear, but he hasn't yet.
I once heard a lecture by an archaeologist who had just had done quite a lot on Roman Britain, but was starting to do some interesting stuff on First World War archaeology. And I said, why are you switching? You know, you've done such marvellous work in Britain, and you've obviously loved it. And he said, I do love it. But he said, there isn't a single house, Roman dwelling, remains of in Britain that we can say this particular person lived here. You could get close to it with the tablets found at the fort of Vindolanda. You know, you know a few of the soldiers who were there, but there isn't, and I think that's right, Ruth, there still isn't, is there just an ordinary villa or house that you can say this definitely belonged to so-and-so? You know, the people's names aren't linked. You have the odd tombstone, the odd reference, but and he said, I would just like to start investigating something where I can tie the people to the scenery.
Mm. Oddly enough, we've just discovered a Roman villa just down the road from where we live. We live close to Cirencester, Carinium, which was the original Roman centre of a Roman province. Everything in Cirencester is the Forum, car park and so on. There's a kind of throughput and a wonderful Roman museum. And in our village, which is 5 miles away, just off the Foss Way, Great Roman Road, they've discovered a villa, but they haven't told us where it is, because the moment they do, the boys come along with their metal detectors. And that, so it's all under wraps until they can get their full team in there, and no doubt it will appear on Time Team. Now, you mentioned, Ros, one of the characters you have, a real-life character. Any other historical characters you tend to use?
Yeah, I do tend to use real people occasionally, but I tend to keep them to minor characters, because I have this slight doubt that it's actually morally justifiable to make a real person your murderer. Well, actually, in the second book, I did have a very nasty man who actually really existed and was quite unpleasant and very argumentative in real life. And in the end, I changed his name because of my feeling that, you know, maybe there would be a descendant somewhere who'd say, William was a nice man, really, you know. So I changed his name slightly to take account of that. But I am very lucky. I mean, I would like to say, first of all, I agree with what's been said here about the little people. I don't think I would ever sort of start writing about King George or any of the queens, you know, or any political figures, Walpole or anybody. They don't really interest me. I'm interested in the little people, the everyday people as well. But I do have some of the real musicians from Newcastle there in the book. But I must admit, I'm very lucky, because there's only one book about these people, and I wrote it. So, first of all, nobody's ever going to say I'm wrong, because only I know whether I am or not. And secondly, I don't have to go out and buy a lot of reference books. I've actually got the original on my computer at home. So, yes, I do, but they tend to be small people. My favourite is a man called Solomon Strolger, which is such a gorgeous name, it just ought to be made up. But in fact, it was real. And I think he was of a Jewish family originally, and he ended up as organist of a church in Newcastle. And I don't know whether my depiction of him is actually accurate. He certainly had 9 children in a very short period of time, and had very elaborate tastes in music, but that's all I know about him. So I sort of invented this man who looks rather like a heron and he's always balancing on one leg. So yes, I do have real people, but as I say, I do tend to keep them to minor characters.
But in the course of research, you sometimes come across somebody who is irresistible. Mm. I've just written a book set in my hometown of Cardiff in 1855, and the chief of police there, Jeremiah Box Stockdale, was such a wonderful character, there was no way you could not have him there. And since it involved a number of jewellery shops, I found a man, this is Cardiff, remember, Wales, and the jeweller whose name I had to mention was Ladislaw Spiridion. Who could invent a name like that? You had to get it in. Can I just ask if any of you have been inspired by other historical crime writers, or indeed going further back, just writers of history?
I've already mentioned Robert Graves and his Claudius books. How long have you got? I suppose in one sense I did do a steal from Ellis Peters, in that I wanted a location for Aurelia when I decided to use a woman, where people came and went and news came to her, because she wouldn't have travelled all over the place. And I thought about the authors I very much admired and thought, now, how does Scatfowl do this? He's somewhere in a religious house, but they do have guests coming in and out because they offer hospitality. And that gave me the idea of the inn. And when I looked into it, the Romans, with their good road system, also had a good system of inns, every day's travel, roughly speaking. And although officially they were only for officials, people who were on the empire's business, but in practice they would have taken private customers, common sense says they would have done, you know, turn somebody away if they pitch up. And that made me think, yeah, she can be an innkeeper. It's a brilliant thing. She does get away from the inn sometimes, but basically she's stationed there and things happen and come to her.
I'm trying to think about this when I realised this was one of the questions that was going to be asked. And I don't know that I am consciously affected by, influenced by any other writer at all. I read a lot, and I think you sort of absorb things by osmosis without really realising it. And I suspect somebody else might look at the books and say, oh, yes, I can see, I don't know, the influence of Ellis Peters or whatever there. But I think it's more of a subconscious thing. The thing that I really have been influenced by, this is going to sound awful, is television, because I do definitely write in scenes, and I think in scenes. And when I first get the idea for a novel, what I actually see in my mind is the opening scene, and I can actually see people walking around in my head, if I can put it that way. But as if it's across the other side of the room with the sound turned down. So I can see things happening, and they're very, very vivid. And at some point, it's as if somebody's turned the sound up and I start to hear words in my head. And I think, oh, I've got to start writing. At that point, if I don't start writing, I lose it. But as long as I sort of get this initial opening scene and maybe two or three highlight scenes through it, and usually the ending, although that can change. And as soon as I get these pictures in my head, I start thinking, yeah, and as soon as they start talking to me, then I know I've got to actually start writing it down. So maybe that's just a result of my sad upbringing in front of Hawaii 5-0. And
my son gave me the idea for writing history. He said, you know, do you realise, Dad, most of your jokes are 400 years old. And if you set them back in context, they might actually work. But the people that inspired me, Robert Louis Stevenson, a wonderful writer writing historical novels. I can't think of a better novel than Kidnap, or Rosemary Sutcliffe, Eagle of the Ninth. Again, I'm sure our friends over there, our Romans, read that. Walter Scott, a much neglected writer now, but a man who had a huge influence in the 19th century, both on French and on Russian writers. Umberto Eco, Name of the Rose. Alfred Duggan, a name not known today, who was Lord Curzon's stepson. For Americans who perhaps don't know, Lord Curzon was the Viceroy of India, immensely rich man, and had this wastrel son called Alfred Duggan, who used to go riding out to hounds in Oxford instead of doing his essays, in fact was sent down, and yet decided to write about the Anglo-Saxon and the early Norman period. There really are wonderful books, and if you want one to start with, The Cunning of the Dove, which is about Edward the Confessor, I would recommend. And finally, perhaps the best of all, H.F.M. Prescott and the Man on a Donkey, about the Pilgrimage of Grace, all wonderfully, beautifully written historical novels. Let's talk about the pitfalls of writing about the past. Jane, you have something to say about this, don't you?
Well, people sometimes say, isn't it hard to remember when you're writing about the ancient past that things like the Industrial Revolution hasn't happened and so on? And, well, yes, you've got to be a bit careful because so many things we take for granted. And in fact, the Romans, there were quite a lot of inventions in Roman times. Heron of Alexandria invented a kind of steam engine, but nobody bothered to use it because they had slave labour, which was free. So you've got to sort of watch a little bit. You've got to remember that the New World hadn't been discovered. But the thing I find really difficult is to remember that the idea pioneered by Freud and his set, the ideas of mental behaviour and mental illness, hadn't been formulated in the way that we now do. Not only that the ideas themselves weren't kicked around, but it's so built into our mindset, isn't it? That, I mean, you can't say, my goodness, you know, how can that man behave so badly, you know, behave so badly? Oh, well, he had a rotten childhood, or, my goodness, why is he flirting with his mother like that? Well, he's got an Oedipus complex, hasn't he? I mean, you can't do it. And yet, I needed somebody in one book to have post-traumatic stress syndrome after a war. So I looked up the symptoms carefully, described them, because I'm sure that there would have been people who had, you know, what would later have been called shell shock if they'd been shells. But I couldn't say, or let any of the characters say, this is the effect that happens when people are at war for a long time. It just had to be left for the reader to make that deduction. And I still find myself having to go through my work quite carefully and say, now, are you sure you're not injecting a modern mindset into this? Does anybody else?
Roger, do you have any pitfalls to worry about?
Well, I carry on with that. Jane has said, that you do have to watch yourself. Edward said in his introduction, you're starting off from the point that people have always been the same. They do, you know, we do suffer jealousy and greed and ambition, and you know, and it's clear from the history books that they were very similar to us, but in many ways they weren't. There's loads of stuff they didn't know, and especially as I say, psychological things that we take for granted just were unknowns, and the ways they could not think, you know. It was down to the gods, you know. The gods said, you know, thunder and lightning to the Greeks. They didn't say it's thundering and lightning. They said Zeus thunders. You know, they actually said Zeus thunders was the expression. So, you know, so much of their lives depended on the gods rather than on our sort of explanation. It's very difficult. You know, how do they express emotions? You know, they were a lot of the men were evaded, trying desperately to avoid falling in love, because love saps your objectivity and intelligence, so that the concept becomes almost alien. That life is structured to avoid it. You know, 30 men married at 30 to a 14-year-old girl. So to make sure she's a virgin, and the children are genuinely your heirs, and then you lock her in the house, and for sex that you enjoy, you use a female slave or a prostitute or a courtesan, depending on how much money you've got, and that was it. And you can't care not to fall in love with them, so. Yeah, there are things you've got to be careful.
Ruth, could you warn people about pitfalls?
Actually, I did put something in the second book where a slightly off-kilter medic has decided possibly you can cure people by talking to them, but Rousseau obviously sets him straight on that point. So that's okay. Apart from that sort of thing, the psychological thing, there's also the sort of physical pitfalls. I mean, you just can't get people from place to place very fast.
If
they've got horses, you have to remember to feed the horses and not send them galloping hundreds of miles and without food and water. Otherwise, people get very upset.
That is true. Distance is much more important, isn't it?
Ross, what about you? Can you think of any pitfalls you had to avoid?
Yeah, I bitterly regret two things. One is that you can't use forensic science in the 18th century, although I did have him studying footprints in the dust at one stage. And the other thing I bitterly regret are Sundays, because Sundays in the 18th century, you were not allowed to travel. You were not allowed to do anything much, in fact, except go to church and read pious books of sermons. So if you have a plot that stretches over several weeks, as I'm just discovering in the present book I'm writing at home, everything seems to come to a halt for 24 hours. Well, you know, the hunt for the villain stops, and simply because they all have to go to church and then sit around for the rest of the day. So you either have to have a dastardly person who just doesn't care about Sunday conventions and is condemned by everybody else for actually travelling, you know, to the local inn or something, or else you just have to somehow get over that 24 hours. But no, Sundays I just don't like.
Right, I did have 24 more questions, but I'm sure some of you in the audience have even better ones. So could we just throw it open to the audience? Yes, please.
I just want to follow up with what Ross was just saying. What do you have your protagonist doing? How does he study?
Well, he went to church. As I say, fortunately, he's an organist, but it wasn't the church in which he played the organ, actually. They sang psalms. And then he had some conversations with various people who were sort of suspects in the crime. And then, fortunately, somebody who didn't care much about conventions turned up with some news. And very, very late on, they started to ride off somewhere, you know, just a minute or two before midnight. So, yeah, it was difficult.
Bill?
Yeah, you mentioned before that you are more interested in little people, people who are everyday people. And I wonder how accurate is our information about them, and could that information be used as a backdrop for your history in school books? Could kids read these in school and say, it may not be the characters, but at least I get a feeling for how that society performed?
Yeah, but then they'd have to explain about prostitution, and I can't see that going down terribly well.
It's not precocious to schoolers.
No, but the great historical novels, as I mentioned, Walter Scott, Robert Louis Stevenson, are taught in schools. I mean, that's how I got involved with writing for history and studying it.
Could these books be used in schools?
Oh, absolutely.
My experience is that if you ask kids to read a book in school, it's the last thing they want to look at.
Well, not necessarily. I have a book called The Merry Devils, which is set in 1593 in the Elizabethan Theatre. It's used on a course in a college in Florida. Whenever they run out of copies, they ring me up and ask me for some more. Wow, everything in it.
What address was that?
Judith.
But Bill's right. Obviously you do have to invent. I mean, ancient Greece, all the written accounts we have, nearly all the documentation is by wealthy aristocratic men. So and very until you get to Aristophanes, you don't get any lower class characters or slaves effectively depicted. So you're inevitably inventing a hell of a lot, but you're hopefully inventing it in context. You know, at least you've got some parts of the jigsaw, and you can deduce the rest from it to a large extent. So yeah, I would have thought that. Well, you know, part of the objective is to try and to create a society that works, that's plausible. You know,
it is. Lady over there.
I'm interested in the fact that you've all chosen amateurs as your detectives. Now, I know you couldn't use policemen, I'm not suggesting that, but you could have used officials of your era, couldn't you? You know, like Cora Harrison uses My Lady Judge. Mm-hmm. Or, in fact, in your 1066 or 1087 series, you use officials, don't
exactly.
you? And you've obviously all deliberately chosen not to use an official, but to use an amateur or several amateurs. Is there some reason for that?
The question is, in case people didn't hear it, why do people use amateur detectives as opposed to people who might be authority figures in their particular period?
I think with my case, using a musician as a detective, it was where I was coming from anyway, because music is obviously my speciality. So I think it was inevitable, though I do have a constable in there as a sort of sidekick occasionally. Yeah.
Well, my character was a doctor before he was a detective, because in the backstory he was a doctor, so he just did a bit of detecting later on. That's how we've ended up where we are.
I honestly had no choice. They just didn't have an investigative law force in Athens. Mm. It didn't exist. They had a body of slaves called the Scythian archers who kept public order, you know, stood around the streets and kept people, you know, stopped riots or brawls or whatever. But there was nobody going. So it was down to citizens who were aggrieved, who felt to find the culprit, and take them to court.
It was pretty much the same situation.
Yeah. So it was a question of finding who is the best amateur to do this.
I didn't have a choice either, really. Deciding to write from a woman's point of view really sealed it, because there were no women officials. She does have both a brother and an occasional romantic interest who are investigators on different parts of the empire, so who might be considered to have some official status. But I there was no way I could have found a plausible way of putting a woman into an official position. Mm.
But amateurs then go on to become professionals in some cases. The obvious example would be Alan Pinkerton, the most famous private detective in history, really, who was nothing but an out-of-work Glaswegian cooper. He went to America to make barrels, and there was a problem in the area of forgery, and he solved it by using logical deduction. And they said, my goodness me, you're clever. And eventually he built up his empire.
Is that how he started?
Yes, that's how he started. He was only in America because he was a member of the Chartist movement and took part in violence in Newport, Gwent. And his name was on a list of people the police wished to interview, even though, oddly enough, his father was a policeman up in Glasgow. And he and his wife, or girlfriend at that time, Joan Farfrae, literally fled to America. And then he worked his way across to what we know is Chicago. Again, an amateur who built up, discovered a particular talent and went on from there. Mm-hmm. Someone else at the back, please.
Oh,
Dan Brown is holy writ. When everything is perfectly accurate.
I refuse to answer that question on the grounds that it might incriminate me, actually.
Any comments on that?
To me, it doesn't matter if there are small mistakes. I try my level best not to have any, and I haven't been caught so far. I'm not saying I haven't got any, but nobody's pointed any out. But tiny mistakes which don't affect the plot, okay, it's annoying. My husband refused to read the Robert Harris Pompeii book because in the first page there's a description of the sky at night over Pompeii, and he's a bit into astronomy, and he said, that's wrong, you'd never have seen those stars from there in August 79. And I said, well, so what? And he said, no. And I said, look, he's done aqueducts and he's done them very well, I can tell you that he has. No. So some people it does put off. But if the thing is so wrong that, as I've just indicated, if I made my woman sleuth some kind of honorary male official in the Roman Empire, that would be so wrong, it wouldn't be worth doing.
On a slightly different tack, my husband works for the police, although he's not a police officer, and he says there is no police officer he knows who will read the Morse books, because the license he has taken with police procedure, and the number of times Morse breaks pace, they just won't read it, they just won't watch it, they're just so annoyed by it.
In fairness to Colin, he will admit quite openly that he doesn't know anything about police procedure. If you come to the police procedural panel first thing tomorrow, 9 o'clock, when I shall also be moderating, then we will delve into that. There are two problems to answer that question. One is the people who do no research, and therefore you can catch them out, and worse still, the people who do too much research and insist in every sentence to load the rift with awe, as our friend Keyes used to say. A friend of ours, perhaps you can understand why this novel was never published, Alanna Knight, a wonderful novelist living up in Edinburgh, was sent a manuscript from an American lady, which was about Mary Queen of Scots and her husband, the Earl of Bothwell. Alanna's written several books about the couple. And the first sentence was, in comes Bothwell, throws off his coat and says, "Hi, honey, I'm bushed, make me a sandwich." You will not be able to buy this in your local bookstore. Anybody else? Please.
It really just picks up from what you've been saying, but what really puts me off if I'm reading a historical book is not slight errors, but when the entire mindset is wrong, when it's just people in fancy dress, really. That really irritates me.
Yeah.
But you do get put off. I mean, there's at least one series where the female lead character goes off on a horse through the forest of the Middle Ages, protected only by two elderly dogs, and you just wouldn't do it. You know, it just women would not do that. They would have to have a man or possibly men to protect, where the novel admits there are bands of outlaws roaming the forest as well.
Do you think, though, if somebody tells a good story, you can forgive them a lot?
Yes, yes, you can.
And to be fair to Dan Brown, my son claims that he hasn't read a book since he was 13. He's now, when he said this, he was 22. The only one he'd actually picked up and read all the way through from start to finish was The Da Vinci Code. Because whatever you may think of the historical research, it's a very good page-turner. So I was very grateful to Dan Brown.
I never thought I'd hear the phrase, be fair to Dan Brown. Judith. Things do come back to haunt you. Think of our members of Parliament. Any more questions? I thought I saw a hand fluttering at the back there somewhere.
Yeah, well, I was wondering, Edward, you've got three series set in different time periods. How any of these questions almost? What differences have you found in dealing with it in different?
Well, you move from area to... I try not to write two books in the same time period. And when I'm going to start a book, the first thing I do is listen to music from the period, just to get you into the mood. And if it's a period when there are newspapers, I will read the newspapers and basically steep myself in the information about that particular period and build up literally a head of steam until one is ready to write. I always do a breakdown of maybe 12 pages, an outline, which tells me what I need to know before I start writing. Then I'll go off and do all the those things, and once I've got it all together, I can start. But I do move about different areas because it's interesting to see the same things happening, recurring throughout history. And I've written about the early Norman period because, and here's another tip, always choose an area that people know something about. 1066, everyone knows the most important date in British history. You don't have to explain too much. 1588, which is when I set my Elizabethan novels, everyone knows that was the Spanish Armada, and you know Elizabeth was on the throne. 1666, the Great Fire of London, and so on. And my series set in the 1850s comes immediately after 1851, the Great Exhibition. So they're all periods that have an inbuilt drama that you simply have to take out. And they're all periods that everybody can, you can assume a certain amount of knowledge about. You don't have to jump out and say, look at me, I've been doing all this research. It's there in everybody's mind. And particularly anyone from my generation, Victorian society is in with... My grandmother was born in Victoria's reign. My grandfather was. My grandmother didn't have electricity in the house. Her room was just like a Victorian living room with gas, antimacassars and aspidistras and so on. On that exciting note, ladies and gentlemen, I will thank you for listening and... tell you that everyone will be signing books afterwards, and shop early for Christmas. Thank you very much.